KPMG for me was the ultimate learning ground. I got a chance to work with some of the brightest minds within the asset management and alternative investment industries in terms of audit within both Jamaica and KPMG Cayman Islands. So there were some big names such as Ben Blair, Sean Cohen, Robert D'Souza, who kind of guided my path during my time there.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. On this week's episode with Kevin McIntosh from Signature and Creed Associates, I made an error. I messed up the intro. So today I've got a separate intro for you. Kevin has a very interesting story. He's a larger than life character. He started off in KPMG, did extremely well in KPMG. In fact, probably needed to go no further in his career, but had a background in working on audit in mutual funds, got to see what was interesting and maybe less interesting than you might expect about the different funds that were out there, progressed into private equity, and eventually now deals individually with firms and a range of fractional CFO services based in Jamaica. Kevin is a really energetic, interesting guy. I really enjoyed my conversation with him, and I hope you will too. Kevin, thank you very much for coming along to the podcast. How are you today? Tell us a bit about where you are in the world.
Thanks, James, for having me. So right now, I'm based in Jamaica, where I'm currently running my own firm with my partner, Denzel White, Signature Creed and Associates. That's where we offer various services, including tax, assurance, and advisory.
Very good. Well, we haven't buried the lead here, but I'm going to go back to the beginning. You got your initial start with KPMG. What was that like, and what initial success did you have there? What made you more successful than the average recruit into their program?
KPMG for me was the ultimate learning ground. I got a chance to work with some of the brightest minds within the asset management and alternative investment industries in terms of audit within both Jamaica and KPMG Cayman Islands. So there were some big names such as Ben Blair, Sean Cohen, Robert D'Souza, who kind of guided my path during my time there. I think what made me successful was not that I was the perfect employee or the perfect client, but more so that I learned quickly from whatever mistakes I made. I think one of the more memorable feedbacks I got from one of the partners was that while my audits may not have been perfect, that I've never made mistakes, if the mistakes were ever identified, they were resolved immediately. So I think that was the nexus in what drove how fast I moved up.
That's interesting because, you know, there's two approaches. I sometimes feel like there's people who are slow and, let's call it slow and steady, get it right the first time. And then there's people who move fast, sometimes things fall off a little bit, but the speed, the amount of time it takes to fix them is far less than the time it would have been to get it totally right the first time. So like there's this trade-off.
Exactly.
And having the, let's say, guts to do that in an audit position, like that just makes you stand out because it's the one thing where it, I feel like this world you're in, and maybe you can tell me, mutual world. So you have sort of the poachers and the gamekeepers. You were the audit side. I get the feeling like there's a lot of spin in the mutual fund world. There's a lot of sales going on, you know, and then you were the guys, tell me, how was it? You're the guys who come in and have to make sure that the spin was a reality. Is that a simplistic view of how it worked?
Well, as simple as I can put it, we're the guys that ensure that all the sales, all the purchases are correct as the fund record reports them, right? Because those funds, as private as they seem, they still have to report to the investors. And our role is to ensure that when those investors get their quarterly or annual NAV packs, which tells them how much what their holdings are valued at the end of any particular period, they want to believe that it's correct. Right, so it's our goal to provide them with that level of security, knowing that whatever that fund is reporting, whatever they bought, whatever they sold, whatever the gains is, that they're telling them that at the end of the year, when they get their financials, that is actually what's there. So as you can imagine, that audit for most funds won't really change.
And what were these? What were these vehicles like? Were they mostly for like, were they institutional investment, or was it for the likes of my pension fund, or what was your typical fund that you would have been auditing?
So it was right across the board. You do have a lot of institutional investors. You do have a lot of pension funds. You do have a private high net worth individuals that would invest in these funds. Right, so it's a mix in between, and then it's a mix in the type of funds as well. You may have some private equity funds, some hedge funds that use deep hedging strategies, some funds that focus on strictly debt strategies, investing in bonds in different parts of the world. Some funds that may just use their typical long short strategies or market neutral strategies. So it's varying strategies, varying funds across varying jurisdictions.
Very good. And maybe you could just touch on a little, I mean, you mentioned you're based in Jamaica. Cayman has an international reputation. How come you were, if you were based in Jamaica, is it because there is a bigger industry over there in Cayman, or what makes the difference between Cayman and Jamaica?
So I think, being based in Jamaica is more so me wanting to see what is in Cayman replicated in Jamaica. Because auditing funds based in Cayman for 5 years, I've always asked the question, why is it that I can't see a similar industry thriving in Jamaica as well? One, we do have the capital market to support it. But for us, even right now, the government is currently trying to implement legislations to ensure that a similar industry can be inputted in Jamaica as well. I know they're working on trust agreements, limited partnership laws, trust laws, to kind of create that ecosystem to support those type of investments. So for me, it's wanting to be a part of that change and trying to drive that change, which is what kind of initially moved me from audit to private equity within Jamaica.
Oh, interesting. So now you're on the other side of the fence, if you like. So you've seen how a lot of these investments work on the back end, I guess across a spectrum. And then later on, with your firm, you've gone into the private equity side, which is actually the deployment of that capital, I guess, to try and achieve the returns. So before we get into the, you know, exactly the PE model, so you have the PE model, you have, you know, just buying stocks and shares, I guess. What were the other, what are the categories that you saw most in these funds? I mean, was it all as glamorous as it sounds, or is it actually fairly straightforward when you peek behind the curtain? Because the guy selling me my pension says all sorts of wonderful things about how exotic and fun and differentiated all this stuff is. But I have my suspicions.
What I say is that every fund will report their strategy from a different perspective, right? A lot of funds that I say will come and say they have a long short strategy, which basically means that they invest long, they take a long view in some stocks, but they'll try to hedge it in terms of which stock they think may go down within a certain timeline to hedge their bets in some respect. You have others that may take a macro point of view to say that they're going to invest using changes in government or international laws and how that may impact certain companies across the world. Others may say, okay, we're going to take a credit view, right? We're going to invest solely in whether sovereign bonds or corporate bonds and to try and gain some form of alpha, because everyone is chasing the elusive alpha. But I think from my perspective, I realize that for most persons or for most funds, when they say what they're beautiful strategy is, everyone comes back to the same few stocks.
Okay.
Right. So it's always interesting to me to have a look at those. But it's a very interesting industry. I love it. There's I think when you're on the side of audit, it becomes, for lack of a better word, monotonous, given that every fund's audit is the same replicated. Because no fund structure changes, really. So you're auditing the same fund over and over again, just a different investment manager, a different management structure. But I've always wanted to know what does it feel like on the other side, right? What does it feel like in the trenches trying to go through those investments? Which kind of,
Okay.
for me, it looking at what I was seeing, it was like if I'm seeing most funds with the same investments with a different strategy, so to speak, it must feel boring. But when you look at private equity, no two, three, or four private equity firms is going to have the same investments, right? Because they're going to be in different jurisdictions, different companies being available for investment, which means that every investment is holistically different. And how you assess that investment is going to be way different as well. So I think that is what kind of pushed me along that line.
Okay, so we've mentioned chasing alpha there. I guess for those who aren't familiar, so alpha is the delta between the standard return, the stock market, and what everyone is selling, right?
On
So
what you can provide to investors, yeah.
yeah, so if you don't provide alpha, quote unquote, then why not just put it in an index? That's, no fund manager would have a business if you just get the index, because you can just do that with Vanguard or whatever, and that's the whole name of the game, providing, getting extra return.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, so they're all kind of vanilla, but you saw they're kind of vanilla. PE is definitely the saucier, spicier end of the investment. I mean, for good and ill, PE has a mixed reputation in the press anyway, let's call it, because there's all sorts of things. So what does you've moved now into your firm, you've jumped the fence, you've seen how a lot of these things work in theory on paper. Now you've jumped the fence working with actual real businesses with your firm, Signature Creed and Associates, very cool. How did you come up with the name?
So I had started my consultancy firm some time ago, within last year. It was very dormant at the time before I decided to revive it this year, called Creed Financial Consultancy. However, as I was starting out, I met my now partner, Denzel White, who had his own firm, Signature Tax and Advisory. And we started talking. After a couple of discussions, we decided, hey, we both want to achieve the same things. We're both on the same trajectory. We think very much alike. Why not go on this road together? So, Creed Financial Consultancy and Signature Tax Advisory came together in Signature Creed and Associates.
Now, so that's something I can empathize with. I mean, I was a what they call a solo founder, and I was horrible at it. I'm like, I was useful. Like, I was just, but I find like, unless I have the social pressure of someone like a partner staring at me, it
Yeah, it
like,
helps. It helps.
yeah. And how long were you working by yourself before you decided to combine forces?
So not very long actually, because I was actually a CFO up to May of this year within private equity, and I decided to launch out within June to start my firm. And as I was launching out, Denzel and I met. And by the end of June, Signature Creed and Associates was formed.
It's a great name. Sounds like it's been around for 100 years. It's modern.
Definitely,
Yeah.
definitely.
Okay, so let me just, I almost skipped over a bit there. So you had a stint in working as CFO in private equity. What did that mean? Does that mean you were parachuted into investments, or you were on the search side? What did you do for these PE firms?
So while in private equity, I was with a firm called Equity Capital Management. I would say my hands were in everything basically. So I wasn't more so in search. That was left up to the CEO. However, I was within investment analysis and assessment, due diligence, risk management, treasury management, and then my portfolio also extended to managing the financial operations of all the portfolio companies.
Wow.
Right, so that included direct portfolio management, ensuring that from a finance perspective, those entities were run properly, and that included about 7 to 8 portfolio companies at the time that I was managing from that perspective. So
So,
it was a very hands-on role.
did you provide like a consolidated balance sheet or P&L, or did you have them all report individually, or practically, operationally, how did that work?
So I had each of them reporting individually at the time, based on the stake that the fund had within them. So that would mean that at the end of every quarter, I had at least 7 or 8 financial statements to ensure that they were prepared on time in order to be reported up to the investment committee and then up to the board.
What were the most important things to have ready for the board? What did they look most for? Or did those statements evolve over time?
So I think initially, at least within my first board meeting, there was no set benchmark yet. Right. So I basically just tried to have everything reported, have the financials prepared to the T based on IFRS and send them through. But I think after the reporting evolved over time, the board really wants to know a few things, right?
Yeah, tell us.
What's the current gross margin? What's the current net margin? What's the current return on capital? What's the expected return on capital based on their budget or forecast that was presented going to the year end? Maybe looking based on the timeline set on those investments, are we on track to meet our expected return or IRR on those investments based on where the company is? No, if not, what strategies do we need to implement to try and ensure that we meet those IRRs over time?
So you mentioned only 5 or 6 KPIs basically there or things that they were really interested in. And then,
yeah, on a go forward basis. So it's like at the end of the year now, that may become a bit more robust based on the year end financials, having to do a lot of variance analysis compared to what the budget was, what the current performance is. And then we may have to take a deeper dive into the exact operations of the company. Do we need to scale back here or no? If we can improve, how do we improve? Do we need to raise additional funds for these companies? So it gets a bit more robust when it comes to hearing.
So who was you were kind of the wicket keeper, let's call it, for these investments. I don't play cricket, so I've probably got that wrong, but like you were keeping score.
But Yeah, exactly.
So who was the operational partner? Was it the individual CEOs in these firms, or was there an investment manager that, you know, was at that board meeting that was trying to answer the questions to be asked by the numbers you were providing?
So we work directly with the CEOs who would take responsibility and also report up to our board as well. So what we try to do for some of these companies that I've invested in, they're classified somewhat as mom and pop shops, meaning that it may be James operating his company, not akin to what corporate lifestyle is. And we go in to try to restructure them to bring them up to that standard. So more than likely, there was never a board of directors in place before. We would have set a board of directors at the company level. Have the CEO report up to that board, who would then report up to the PE board. But you do have set times within the year where it would have almost like a all CEOs meeting, where the CEOs for the portfolio companies would make a presentation to the board of the private equity company to kind of bring them through the strategies of the coming year.
Okay, got it. So, and then they were setting the vision and you were showing what the numbers said so the board could...
Exactly.
Okay. So with your new firm then, so this was one step out of, you know, you're moving slowly towards what I call the real world. So you're working now with your new firm. What's the ideal sort of candidate that you would work with now? Is it these firms is this at the individual company level now? You're working in collaboration with PE firms, or is it any type of business that you're looking for?
So for me, it's a bit of both in terms of I'll work with the institutional investor and I'll also work directly with the company. My main stake right now is directly with the company because I think that's where I add more value. I do right now. I have clients where I'm assisting them from a fractional CFO perspective, guiding them in terms of restructuring their financials internally. I have clients where I'm guiding them through acquisitions, helping them with due diligence, building out their financial assessment models for those investments. And then we do have clients that we have other ad hoc advisor services that we provide, whether it is from a financial reporting perspective, helping them to ensure their financials that go out to investors are compliant with IFRS. Because especially within Jamaica, we have some companies operate on somewhat of a unstructured manner, right? They've been doing everything internally for themselves,
right,
without regard for what the standards are, what the relevant regulatory compliance standards are, or what financial reporting standards are. So when they come to that stage now where they have to be reporting to investors, it's a different ball game for which they've not been playing before.
Right.
So that's a ground that I assist with as well, to bring them up to scratch in terms of what they need to be and guide them on the way forward.
Okay, so we've all heard, and a lot of us will have seen, these $50 million companies running on QuickBooks. You're like, how the hell did they ever get this far? But they have, and they seem to be making, almost in spite of themselves, according to what the rule book says. You think, well, how could this ever succeed? And they don't teach you this in Harvard Business School. And here we go, these amazing businesses throwing off cash. So what are the go-tos when you deal with a new client? Let's say you take your avatar here of a successful business, maybe informal, sounds a little bit like the way companies are run in Ireland sometimes. Do you have a playbook to get them up to speed, or is it just firefighting, or how do you approach? Because there's a lot of things you could fix. Where do you start?
Exactly. There is a lot of things that you can fix, but then not every client needs the same playbook, right?
Right.
So I always try to have an initial scoping meeting with each client, maybe 1 or 2 hours, depending on how bad the situation is, maybe more, to have a deep dive into what exactly the problem is. Because you do have the clients that have the software in place, they have the people in place, but no one has a clue what they're doing or how they should be doing it.
Right.
So their problem more so is on the people side, not the process side, right? But then you have those that have the people but have no process entirely. I've gone into businesses before, and when I say, okay, how do you do your accounting? How do you record everything? Excel.
Right.
In trust me, in this day and age, people are still going through Excel.
I know. I've seen it.
So it's just a matter of, how do I now bring them from point A to point B? Which I would be lying if I said that it's going to be the same process for everyone. It's going to be very different for every client, right? You have some where I have to start, especially if it's not a detailed, broken out organizational chart with 5 or 6 persons in finance, 7 or 8 persons in operations, sales team. You do have those five persons enterprises where, even though it's 5, you would think that it should be easily run. You do find that those smaller enterprises have the most issues, right? So it's, how do you provide a change of mindset to them first before you bring them to change, you know, whether it is a process, technology, bring them through that rubric, because you might fix the processes, fix technology, not have the direct interaction with the people, and then everything breaks down when you leave.
Okay. So I've got, okay. So if you're going from Excel, right, your standard choice is go get some kind of ERP, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. But I've also heard other fractional CFOs describe as putting an ERP as like pouring concrete around your business processes.
That's true. Right. So for me, I know you mentioned QuickBooks before, but don't fight out QuickBooks, right? Whether it is QuickBooks, QuickBooks Zero, those software are very, very useful, up to a certain size, of course.
Yeah.
But you find that the transition from an Excel to a QuickBooks or a Zero is very, very simple. And it's easy to train these smaller enterprises on as well, in terms of guiding them how to move forward. But as you said, when it comes to a large ERP that may take 6 to 7 months to implement, in worst cases, 2 to 3 years, that's where you do have a problem. And that's where you kind of realize an ERP is not for everyone, right? Sometimes you can find a way to make the simpler ERP, such as the QuickBooks or Zero, work for your enterprise up to a certain size, of course.
Yeah.
Because up to a point, when you're tracking $7 or $13 billion PP&E register are tracking that amount of sales, you need something that is robust and can give you direct information rather than you checking through a long list of data.
Well, that's the trade-off. I mean, I spoke with a CFO this morning at a unicorn business, and they had bought, before he arrived, they had bought NetSuite. It was bought and paid for on the shelf, and they were still using three versions of Xero, three different instances of it, you know. So, and I could, I mean, it's easy to say that sounds silly, but I can see how it happens.
It's not silly. It's for some, it's a nightmare. For some, it's, I mean, when it's implemented and everyone understands, it's beautiful.
Right.
But to get to that road for full implementation, full utility,
yeah,
and full understanding from the team, it's going to be a rocky road.
And have you experience with like a NetSuite, or is there an ERP in Jamaica that's specialized, or do you generally just say, hold on, let's take a pragmatic approach, we're going to make Kevin's software special here? How do you go? What do you normally do?
So for me, I'm not so big when it comes to ERP, right? If there's need for ERP, I have partners I'd call in to have that sorting, because I'm not the best when it comes to those ERP. Before I even get to an ERP, I always try to find a workaround, right? Especially if you're jumping to an ERP just for jumping's sake, I like to pull your shirt back and pull you back and ask you, okay, let's think about this first before, because if it's size, we can reassess why you're moving to the ERP. If you just want to be flashy, that we have Sage or we have Oracle or we have NetSuite, I think we need to rethink all of that before we move forward. Right, think about how will that impact your current operations. What's the lead time in terms of getting the ERP, to implementing the ERP, to training the staff to fully use the ERP? What you're using now, is there a workaround that we can use to bridge the gap to fill any risk that you think is within your financial reporting framework, rather than spending maybe $200,000 or $300,000 US to implement something new?
Yeah. And I mean, this comes back a little bit to your start of your career, where you're moving fast to fix things, and you know, sometimes it's quicker to catch the mistakes than it is to plan everything out perfectly. And
exactly,
you know, and this is why ERPs have such a rocky reputation with implementation, because you know it's hard to get it perfect. In fact, it's never perfect. And this is why you need something interim sometimes. Let's talk a little bit about the current trends, if you like, in the industry when it comes to maybe Jamaica or more generally. What are you seeing? How has things changed? How the fractional CFOs and CFOs are working, you know, now over the next couple of years? What's changing in that regard?
So I think the change is that the idea of a fractional CFO is now being somewhat accepted within Jamaica. Because before, there was no such thing as a fractional CFO in Jamaica. I think over the last 2 or 3 years, that idea has changed, because companies, especially smaller SMBs, they're realizing they don't really need a full-time CFO, right? And the cost of a full-time CFO compared to the value that they're getting is not matching up. What you need is someone maybe that comes in once or twice per week, can be on call if you need to, if there's a large issue that needs to be resolved. Mm-hmm. But if you're not, let's say, over $2 or $3 billion in Jamaican terms, rather, locally, why do you need a CFO to drive the business, right? You have your sales team, you have your operations team, you have the CEO or manager, whoever that is. You do have your internal accounting team. You have a chief accountant who does the books. But if you need someone to assist on strategy, risk management, you may not need that person full time, right? You may need that person once or twice for the week, have a monthly catch up call just to go through what the pain points are, assist you to iron them out, and then move from there. When you get to a larger organization going up, then you may need someone internally full time to assist. So I see that trend towards the fractional CFO growing a bit. I also see a lot of companies being scared of what AI is and how AI is going to impact their business. So we find a lot of AI advisory type companies coming out, mixing that with finance to see how we can assist AI to improve the financial and accounting process within companies. So that is something that we're looking at as well.
Yeah, I did an interview with a guy called Ben Mickey, and he trains, he provides training for people on how to hire a fractional CFO. And he said something that really rang a bell with me, which is the CFO hire is the only hire where you can go and say, listen, what I actually want is $5 million in my back pocket in 4 years' time. Right, that's the only hire you can say, and you can't say that to anyone else. Pretty much, you know, you can talk to the
sales. That's true.
And they're the only one who can actually really set about doing that. You know, you can kind of be busy and doing lots of things, but if you actually want to plan, let's say whatever your cash objective is in your tax paid, you know, account, you just can't say that. And there's no other hire you can make that could possibly even really purposefully start to address that, you know. And so that, and let's be honest, that's why we're all here, right? That's it. That's true.
Yeah. And that's some of the conversations I have, because even as a fractional CFO, the first question I ask them is what would make this engagement successful?
Right.
If after 6 months, after 12 months, when we look back at the day that we're signing the contract, what would you say that made this engagement successful? Most of them will come back and say, okay, we have enough cash runway for 12 months or 18 months. Depending on their situation, may say that they've restructured their balance sheet to the point where it's a bit more cost effective in terms of the cost of capital. Others will say they've seen a growth in revenue within their requested benchmark, whether it is 8 to 10% or 15-20%. So that is kind of what you set initially, because that is our role, right? We assist you to meet your financial targets.
Can I admit something to you?
Sure.
Oh, I've heard that term, restructure the balance sheet. And I always hear it and I go, oh yeah, we must restructure the balance sheet. I'm like, I'm kind of nodding along. What's a euphemism for? What's it mean? What is it?
So restructuring the balance sheet really focuses on how the balance sheet is capitalized, right? You have companies who may be operating for a while without cause for what the outcome is for the decisions they've made in how they raise capital. So they may decide in the initial outset, all right, I'm gonna capitalize my business, whether it is by 70% debt, 30% equity. Or they may say, all right, I'm going to go straight debt and leverage everything and just try to get the most returns out of this company. But then 2 or 3 years down the line, they're up to their neck in interest expense. Business is not operating as it should, not generating the cash flow needed to repay the leverage. Then they decide, all right, I need to find a way to make this balance sheet as cost effective as possible so that I don't run out of cash easily. If I have other investors, I can potentially start returning some dividends to those investors. If it's just me, I can find a way to start returning some dividends to myself and not paying that money out to someone else.
I knew it was just a fancy way of saying putting money in my bank account. That's what I'm hearing here, right? So, okay. In some instances.
So,
right?
So it is really about how do we make the cost of capital as cheap as possible.
Right.
But also, it also brings into context your working capital needs as well, right? Because you do have situations where companies have been atrocious in how they manage the working capital and the balance sheet,
right?
That they can no longer cover their short-term obligations. They can't pay their staff, they can't pay their suppliers, mainly because in some instances they don't track how they spend cash. So there's a model that finance people love to use, which is a 13-week cash flow, which kind of manages how you spend over the next 13 weeks. They have nothing of that sort to kind of manage how they manage the cash flow. They don't track their receivables as good as they should.
Right.
So you have receivables running 60, 90 days, but then you have suppliers on a 30-day or 45-day pay period that needs to be paid, but you can't pay because you're not collecting. Right? So that becomes a part of your balance sheet restructure as well, in where you try to manage the relationship between your debtors and your creditors. In some instances, the initial outset will be to start to speak to your suppliers, maybe seek some additional credit term to give you enough time to fix the issue on the top, which is at the receivables, inventory, if there's inventory, and cash management perspective, collect on those receivables. If you need to factor in worst case scenario, you have to start factoring to get some cash in to start repaying creditors and moving forward from there. So it's not just about capital management, but it's also working capital management as well, to basically to allow cash to flow freely through the business.
Okay, well, I can see why now every quarter when we do our board meeting, you know, we have this section where we look at the P&L, and then we have a brief moment while our accountant on the board looks at the balance sheet. You know, everyone just sits there while he says some stuff and no one really knows what's happening. But then I get it. It's important. So CFOs love balance sheets. That's all I know. Accountants seem to really love them.
Well, I think from my perspective, I love the cash flow statement better, which right. is why I always try to ensure that every financials have one. I know some companies internally, they'll just give you the income statement and the balance sheet. But for me, the cash flow statement tells the tale of everything else. Because if there's no operating cash flow, there's really no money in the business.
Cash is king.
Cash is king.
Great. Okay. Well, before we move on to my business hero question, I just want to ask, like, how can people get in touch with you? We've had a flavor of your style and your energy and what you bring to the CFO role. So how can we reach out to you, Kevin?
I'm always active on LinkedIn at Kevin McIntosh, so they can always reach out to me there. They can visit our website, signaturecreed.com.
Great.
And you can always email me, kevin@signaturecreed.com.
Super. All right. And here we go. What you have all been waiting for. Kevin, who is your business hero and why?
So I have a preference for accountants who've made it to the top.
Yeah.
So one of my business hero locally in Jamaica is Don Webby. He is currently the group CEO for Grace Kennedy. He started out within the finance department as head of, I think he was group financial manager. Then he went up to CFO. Then he's now the group CEO, right? So I kind of love those movements for persons within finance and accounts to know that you don't really have to remain in the finance role. You can always move up to leadership.
Yeah, because like in Europe here, it's a well-trodden route for the CFO to become CEO. In the States, it's more commonly the sales or leaders that ascend. So yes. You're in the middle there, somewhere in the Atlantic, right? Almost. So it sounds like this guy, it sounds like that in Jamaica anyway, there is that opportunity for finance people to get the top job.
Or yeah.
Yeah.
Well, in not all the time, but in some respect, yes, they do.
Yeah, very cool. I love that. And I see he's had a bit of a career in politics as well. Inspirational guy. I love it. I haven't heard that one before. Thanks for that. I love it when someone brings something new I haven't heard of before. So, Kevin, you've been a star. And if you are still listening at this stage, you are a real star. Congratulations. You have earned the right to go to procurementexpress.com/newsletter. Sign up for the newsletter. You get direct knowledge bombs from the likes of Kevin into your email inbox every week. So I encourage you to sign up there. If you are interested in using our software to help you manage your purchasing, you can go to procurementexpress.com/partners. We have a special deal for CFOs. It's not really a deal. It's more like a training where we give you a deep dive on what our software does. If you want to improve purchasing within an organization without committing to an ERP, you want to stop the bleed, you want to improve processes, get approvals around spend, improve your cash flow. That's something we can do for you in 5 to 6 weeks. So go to procurementexpress.com/partners and we'll sort you out. Kevin, you have been a star. Thank you very much for being on the show this week.
Yeah, man. Thank you for having me.